Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025.
Today, cash flow analysis for capital budgeting. This is actually a fairly short lecture. I'm going to show you a spreadsheet approach that will be of use to you, at least some of you, in later courses. And it's an automated way to create projections of your free cash flow across a period of time. And it's like my other spreadsheet. As soon as you fill in a bunch of white blocks, the rest of the problem becomes very straightforward to you. And I will show you that. And I will also address some new concept that I haven't brought up in class yet. Nothing really intense, but it's something that is worth you knowing about. But before I do that, a look at the numbers. And today was something of a bear day, but it was kind of a dull bear day. It wasn't anything spectacular at all. You had the Dow was up, actually, surprisingly, almost 0.75%. But then, not the normal, the S&P 500 was down just a little more than just a little tiny bit. And then the NASDAQ was down about 0.5%. It wasn't spectacular, but you did see the Dow rising when the other ones were not doing so well. But on the other side of the world, the Nikkei had a rocky session. It kept bouncing down, up and then down, and it finally did a real surge at the end of their day, which would have been in the middle of the night here. But it finally finished up some, and the Hang Seng finished up. So the Asian markets were doing good today. They were feeling good about themselves. And, of course, Europe was doing pretty good, too, all around. London had an odd day, sort of like the Nikkei did. It was just sort of down, up, then down, and then up, and finished up a little tiny bit. But the bottom line is that the U.S. markets are really split on what's going on right now. And if you look at the VIX measures volatility, and it had a good surge early today, or earlier, a few hours ago, and then it's calmed down a little bit, as you can see from that spark chart there. Well, let me take you down here. Some interesting news. Here's gold. Gold is beginning to make a run upward again. It had made a run toward $5,000 an ounce. If you recall, that was like a month ago or so. And then it chickened out and it went down to 4,000, dipped a little below it. Well, now it's coming back again. Again, the rumors are starting up, the worry about what's coming in the next 12 months and all of that kind of stuff. But as far as oil is concerned, it is just the price of oil is just dropping like a rock now, and that's just a huge supply of oil pouring into the market from the OPEC plus nations, and that just is driving the price down. Supply of oil is just ridiculously high, and so the price of oil is very low, and we should see lower gas prices, but that's just not, we just aren't seeing it yet. The lower gas prices should be coming at some point, but maybe not for a while. Now, here's the annoying thing here is that this Yahoo Finance, sometimes instead of giving the yield on a bond, it'll give the price. Price and yield are inversely related, of course. So you will see that the price was actually falling, which would cause the yield to rise. But it's kind of come up. It's not really above where it started today, but we are seeing bond prices as commensurate with higher interest rates. Lower bond prices mean higher interest rates, and hence we are having one of those deterrents to economic expansion. Higher interest rates slow everything down. You've seen what I do, net present values of a project. As you increase the discount rate, it's more and more likely that you'll reject the project. That's exactly what's going on. As higher interest rates begin to move into the economy, there will be more projects that will be rejected. That means no more new job formation, all that kind of good stuff. No longer people borrowing to buy homes, to buy cars, things like that. So higher interest rates are a deterrent to economic growth. And if this higher and higher interest rates holds, which it looks like it's going to, we should begin to see the evidence of it in less economic activity. Right now, if we look at private sources of economic data, not the public sources, which are just not trustworthy right now, we do see that there is a great deal of slowdown in the economy in many sectors. And there's also a significant upsurge in inflation. Notwithstanding what the government's numbers are, the private numbers are looking very serious in terms of higher inflation, higher food prices, higher housing prices. Those kinds of things are definitely showing up now. And I'm sure most of you are seeing how much more difficult it is to keep in your budget when you're buying food and stuff like that right now. But the one that's kind of a worry right now is gold is making its surge. It's making another run upward. And as gold goes upward, that is a sign that down the road we're going to have something bad happen in terms of the economy. Look at the sectors here. Very unusual for the technology sector to be down for the day. As the broad-based, it's not down a lot, but there is profit-taking going on. You see, look at this balance. You see bull and bear both happening here. And basically, technology sector is such a huge part of the economy that if it's sliding, then that means that overall the markets are sliding. And so you've got a little bit of unpleasant look to that. What was I thinking? I was going to show you a couple of stocks. One thing that I do want to revisit right now is the agriculture sector. ConAgra would be one. Oh, come on. ConAgra, yeah, CAG. In that sector, we had a mildly bullish day, and what I would want to invite you to see is the yield to date on the ag sector. We have a major problem because we have alienated quite a bit of the world. China was a massive buyer of soybeans, and they no longer want to buy our soybeans. So we have a lot of farmers, all they can do is plow the soybeans under because there's no market to sell them. And that's not something that's going to we'll get back to the old deals later on in a year or two. They've already established new markets where they're buying their soybeans. And so the Chinese, who are a huge buyer, they won't come back because they've already created new supply chains. They're very good at adapting, and they don't return if there's an unreliable trading partner. And so that one is gone, and since you're seeing this sector beginning to slide. This is agriculture. Now, another part of this is that there in the meats, let's look at meats, and I will look at one real quick here, just Tyson, just to give you an idea. Tyson was down. Wow, it was really down for the day. Now look at the year to date. You notice that there is a trending downward, even in Tyson, which specializes in poultry. It is more magnified in other parts of this of this part of agriculture. And it works like this. When grain prices are unfavorable, you will see the cattle ranchers and the pig farmers slaughter their herds, get rid of them. That will cause the supply of pork and beef to go up, and that will drive the price of it down. Hence why a while back you saw a lot of cheap pork. And you saw a year or so earlier, you saw cheap beef. Now the problem here is that after that, the herds aren't there anymore, and therefore you begin to see the other side of it. They don't have cattle to slaughter, they don't have pigs to slaughter. So what happens is then the supply of those at the meat counter goes down and the prices begin to skyrocket. This is exactly what you're seeing right now with pork. A couple of months ago, it was very cheap. But now that they are in the thin herds, there isn't much of it out there. So you're seeing the price of pork. Go to the store and look at it, it'll stagger you. It is very high now. And it's not expected to recover very soon. So this is the cyclical nature of these businesses. It's from good times to bad times. They have grain prices get bad, so they slaughter the herds, and then that means that you get great prices at the grocery store, but then some years later, there are no herds out there. The herds have been thinned down to nothing, and then you see the prices of meats going through the roof, which is what we're seeing right now. First it happened with cattle, and now it's happening with pork. This is how we think about things in finance, in terms of markets, supply and demand, and what those do to drive commodities up and down. And it's just something to think about when you're looking at stocks to buy. Is this a good time to buy Tyson? Is this a good time to buy ConAgra? Probably not. Let me take you over here to ConocoPhillips. This is an oil company. Conoco is down for the day rather noticeably. Let's look at the yield to date. Well, with all these cheap prices, you're going to get a lot of supply of oil, and that's going to make it cheaper for them to buy the raw materials, the oil, the hydrocarbon products, to refine and then sell. That should be a good thing, but actually not really. If you're going to have the prices getting too low for the final products, even if the raw resources are getting cheap, if you can't get a lot of selling of it done, then you're going to have a sell-off in the market. Another one in this, by the way, let's look real quick. Notice the beta. These are very safe stocks. Why? Because it's one of those basics of life. They produce stuff that we need so much, the hydrocarbon products. MRO, Marathon Oil. Marathon had a good day today. Kind of a odd kind of, wait, no it didn't. It's not even showing it. Let's look at the year to date. Come on, year to date. Now Marathon Oil is on the other side of this coin. And notice that Marathon Oil, no, come on, MRO, no wonder. I thought they had a kind of a crappy day. I don't remember. Marathon Petroleum, MPC. Yeah, okay, that's better. Now, notice again, the beta is below 1. These are companies that produce basics of life. Gasoline, diesel, kerosene, jet fuel. Really fundamentals that are needed all the time, and they are not as subject to the ups and downs of the economy. Now, if we look at the year to date, Marathon bucks the trend. It is definitely a stock that is one you might want to look at simply because it has a low beta, and if we were to look at this right now, the problem is that it is projected not to make a lot of money. If I were to do a real quick shot on this, just to remind you not to forget how to do this, I would take
their projected price in 1 year of $199, and I would divide that by the current price, $198.43, minus one, and then times it by 100. That is a capital gain of 0.28%. That's terrible. That's a really terrible gain. Now, even though Marathon looks like it's rising in percentage terms, the projection is that it won't earn you, it'll earn you about a fourth of a percent on the stock price. Now, if I add in the dividend, you get a, what is that dividend, 2%? The total holding period return for Marathon Oil is a lousy 2.29% for holding it for a year. I mean, even though the beta is less than one, it's 0.77, and that's, you should make something off it. This is a terrible investment, and that kind of might surprise you. It's oil, isn't oil, you know, a great thing right now? Not really, because the oil prices are low, so they're getting the raw materials at a good price, but there's not much they're making out at the retail level from those oil products. So this is a sector that might not be a good idea to play in. You saw ConocoPhillips is in bad shape. Marathon's not going to return you anything worth your investment dollars. So this is a sector that you might want to avoid if you are investing. And all I'm doing in these things is telling you how to think about these markets. Just look at the numbers and then begin to think in terms of a professional. You've had economics, you've had a finance class. Is this really something that's right for me in my portfolio? And in a case like this, you would reasonably conclude absolutely not. These are terrible. We've seen stocks with betas below one, like Verizon, AT&T, that had outstanding returns coming in. Anyway, enough of that. Let me take you over. I've put up a new version of this free cash flow spreadsheet. I did it just a few hours ago. Makes a few things a little clearer for you. So what I would ask you to do is go to your spreadsheets in Canvas and then go down to free cash flow and download it and let it overwrite the one that you've already got. And while you're doing that, go ahead and log into your Canvas, or rather to your attendance radar before I forget like I did on Monday. And we'll grab this. Why is it? There we go. Yeah, go ahead and do your attendance radar while this is loading. Now, let me give you the contours of this. What this sheet does, and it's a slightly simplified version of the one that I use in upper level classes, but it has almost all of the same moving parts. I have adapted this one so that it works with your textbook. And the critical part in the textbook that is important for me, so I really had to do a simplification, is that the textbook assumes that you depreciate the entire capital investment right away. And as I said on Monday, that is very unlikely to happen. There are some things that you can depreciate all of it at once. In other words, you can expense the capital investment. but they are pretty rare. Normally, you would have a depreciation expense. You would depreciate it over a period of years. But for the purposes of making this so that it's more relevant to the textbook, they call it bonus depreciation. In other words, how much of the capital investment do you get to depreciate in the zero, in year zero? And so, as you see in here, the bonus depreciation I set at 100%, like the book does. And that's the major simplification. Everything else is pretty straightforward, and it's actually one that is worth you taking away from this class if you have to do a projection of financials for a project. This one's a four-year, and it's not hard to do it for more years than that. But let me take you down through here. You tell it how many sales, how many units, and what the price per unit is. It will automatically calculate your revenue for the first year. And then, as is typical, we usually consider your cost of goods sold as a percentage of revenues. And that, in other words, we instead just say, okay, 40%. And we do the same for the selling, general, and administrative expenses. Here's the first thing to talk about briefly. Well, where would I get those numbers? There are a couple of ways. If you got a new project, what you could look at is the financials of other corporations, comps, that make a product like this. What is their percentage? What's their percent of cost of goods sold as revenue? And what, as far as selling, general, and administrative expenses, what do we see as the overall industry average for those? And there are resources that you have available here, like Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage, that can give you those percentages for industries. There's another approach that some companies take where they put a target. They look at the industry, sure, but then they say, we want to target a specific percentage. Cost of goods sold, we want 36%. We're going to do everything we can to hold our cost of goods sold as 36% of revenues. And our selling, general, and administrative expenses, we are going to set a target. We want those to be 22%. Or whatever. So you can either use for your projections what the industry has experienced, or you can use for those percentages what your internal decision making is saying is what we want to do, what we want to accomplish. Now, this is that initial increase in inventory I told you about on Monday. You're going to have to buy inventory to start the process, to start it. And you'll do that in year zero. I'm not sure if I told you this story, but it's an actual true story from right near here. There was a restaurant that was going to go start up. It had done a lot of promotion, marketing, a little bit on the upscale side, really exciting. They put out social media. They did targeted radio ads that our opening is today, is some date that they gave. Well, it was. They opened up the restaurant. You had all these better people of the community coming in because we've got to try a new restaurant, which you've seen with the long lines for other restaurants that start opened up. And then they realized they had not bought any inventory. Their freezers were empty. Opened this thing up, and there wasn't any inventory to make food. Nothing, or close to nothing. Well, it was an absolute fiasco. And the restaurant closed and never opened back up. And that's why the inventory happens in year zero. See how that change in net operating working capital? That's inventory going up by $100,000. Change in net operating working capital. So that's a part of the initial investment. that you saw there when I was doing those NPVs, that's part of it, is inventory. You spike it up. You load up the warehouse, load up the freezers, whatever it is. And that happens in year zero or in period zero, whatever you want. Okay, now the initial capital investment here will do $900,000. That's what it's going to cost for all the equipment and all of that kind of stuff. And this is that bonus depreciation. What that means, and I'm doing this so that it's compatible with the textbook, it means that we're going to just depreciate, we are allowed to depreciate the entire amount of the capital expenditure right away. That's not realistic, but, you know, here we are. Otherwise, you're going to choose straight line or accelerated cost recovery. One of those, some companies still use sum of years digits or reverse sum of years digits, as we used to call it. Now, this line right here, spontaneous financing. And I go into this in a lot of detail in my short-term financial management course. Here's how companies play. You want short-term money just to get things kicking or to get something underway. Now, there are all kinds of short-term capital money markets. I showed you some of them, commercial paper and all that kind of stuff. However, there's another way that companies can borrow money for a short term. In fact, even for a long term if they want to, as we show here. And companies actually use this. It's called spontaneous financing. I don't know how far I can go with this. You, sir, have you ever put off paying a bill until another month? I send you a bill for $400. And you would pay it, except that you decided that you won't pay it. That frees up $400 for you to use this month. You could even buy a friend an extra couple of cheeseburgers a day. But that's what we call spontaneous financing. You're actually creating cash out of nowhere by putting it on your suppliers or where your accounts payable. You just delay payments on your accounts payable or on other obligations. Your wages payable. Companies have even done it on their wages payable. By slowing down paying bills, you actually generate financing. And it's classically done. And it actually helps a company in the short run by putting off paying bills. And it helps their cash flow cycle because they are getting money in at their normal rate, but the money is flowing out at a slower rate. So their cash conversion accelerates. So in other words, we use days to describe this. And I don't expect you to know to get much of the details of what I'm saying here, but I'm going to tell you something interesting about this. Most companies have a cash conversion cycle of 40 to 50 days, maybe 30 days. Well, one way that you can accelerate it down to 20 to 30 days is just put off paying your accounts payable. It actually accelerates the amount of money coming in relative to the amount of money going out. Some companies take this to an extreme. A famous example, which I show in my FIL 340 class, is Walmart. Walmart actually has a negative cash conversion cycle. Essentially, Walmart finances all of its short-term operations by not paying its suppliers until long after they normally would. And so it's ingenious that they can actually cause their spontaneous financing. Financing that is just because they are accumulating cash coming in so much faster than they are dispersing the cash out, that they literally have a negative cash conversion cycle, which is almost unheard of. What they're doing, as I said, is essentially using their suppliers to finance their short-term operations. And that's what we're doing here. A lot of companies, you know, you see this 900,000. Okay, we're going to have to go out and go to the capital markets and borrow $900,000. No, you can actually do some of that financing by just slowing down your accounts payable, how fast you pay your bills. That's what spontaneous financing does, and it is very much used as part of the whole financing package for many companies. We don't have to raise $900,000. How much can we slow down paying bills to generate some extra cash flow? And in this case, I do a very modest amount, and I'll show you the effect of this in just a little while. Life of the project, you can put in 4 years. This is a four-year model here, so it'll be 4 years. Now, the book value at the end of the project is obvious because, in this case, we're depreciating the whole amount right away. So the book value is zero right after the beginning, so it's zero at the end. The company has the book value. They depreciated all of the capital expenditures out right away. So that's why that's a zero. I'm using the current tax rate of 21%, and we're saying let's have a salvage value of $100,000. Now remember that here the book value is zero. So they are going to face tax on $100,000 minus $0 at the end because there's no book value left at the end. Okay, and you can see that effect right here. If we look at the salvage value, it's $100,000 here, but it's only $79,000 here. That's because they had to pay a 21% tax on the whole salvage value because there was no book value to it. So it's $100,000 minus zero times 1 minus the 0.21. That's why it's $79,000, and that's calculated for you. Now, if I go, and we're going to use a discount rate of 5%, and we're going to use a hurdle rate of 10%. The discount rate of 8.5% will be for NPV. The hurdle rate will be for internal rate of return decision. And we have a zero growth rate of revenues to start with. But you can change that. But if we go through it, as you can see, we are selling 50,000 units at $3.50 each, so it'll be $175,000. That's year one, and because there's no growth, it will stay that for the life of the project, for your life. And then you go through cost of goods sold, just 40% of the $175,000, so your gross income is $175,000 minus $70,000. What I'm trying to do here is to show you that these models, if you've got a little bit of Excel behind you, which all of you do now, and I thank you for getting that all done for me, you and for yourselves, you can see that these are just pretty much basic. You just have to walk it down, and then you can copy and paste everything over. But anyway, in year zero, you have the capital expenditure is $900,000 with bonus depreciation of 100%. You wipe it all out, you're depreciated all the way immediately, $900,000. Your spontaneous financing comes over to help kill off some of that expenditure. Your net operating working capital goes up by the $100,000 of the inventory. And notice over here, once at the end of the project, you sell off that inventory, but you don't buy it again, so you get to recover that inventory cost from the beginning. And then the salvage value is for here at the end. And all it is from here is just adding up the numbers, you know, following the pluses and the minuses and all that good stuff. And you get the free cash flow, and that's what matters to us. Profit means nothing. What matters is the free cash flow from this. And notice there's no depreciation expense along the way because we depreciated it at all at the beginning. So anyway, here we are. At the end, all you do for these is you find the present net present value of the future expected cash flows discounted at 10%, we accept the project. Now, if you want to use the internal rate of return and the hurdle rate, the internal rate of return is 12%. At a hurdle rate of 10%, you accept it, because any internal rate of return above the hurdle rate, you accept. And then the profitability index is just a summary way of saying the NPV. So we've got a profitability index. It's definitely yes. So you're going to accept for all of these. Now, let's take just one to throw something in here. Let's say that we have a modest growth rate of sales over the life of this project of, let's say, 3%. Now, watch what will happen up here to your revenues and everything else. They grow at 3%. And so all of your other numbers adjust automatically. And you can see that it's even better now with a growth rate of 3%. So now let's do a few other things. Now this is called sensitivity analysis. And this is the last part of that chapter in the book. This is where you play with the numbers. What if this number is this? How sensitive is the model, is the decision to different scenarios? Now, right now, we've got definitely this is a go. How much can we push it? Well, what happens if our cost of goods sold isn't 40%, it's 45%? Ooh, look at that. NPV is still a go with profitability index, but if you're using hurdle rate, it's a no. So this model seems to be at least somewhat sensitive to your cost of goods sold. Matter of fact, we can even play down a little bit. Well, what happens if that's 43% instead of 45%? Whoa. It's very touchy around 43 to 45%. At 43%, we're still okay. It's a go. But if it's 45% and we're using an IRR and hurdle rate, then it's a no-go at 45%. It's okay at 43%. So in other words, we have now seen that this project seems to be rather touchy right around in the 40 to 45% range to the cost of goods sold. Well, let's put that one back to 40%, and let's look at the SG&A. How sensitive is that? Let's take it up to 25% and see what happens to the... Oh, look at this. It is interesting because if it looks to me like this project, if you're using internal rate of return, it is very touchy about those changes. But if you're using net present value approach, it's still, hey, that's okay with us. So we now know something about how this, whether or not this project is going to be a go or a no-go. If we use IRR, it's highly sensitive, right around 20 to 25% on selling, general, and administrative expenses. It's touchy in the 40 to 45% range on cost of goods sold. And it's both of those are touchy only with if you're using hurdle rates, internal rate of return. If you're using NPV, they're still good. So that tells you something about how your company's policy, internal rate of return or net present value, affects your capital decisions. Now let me take that one back down. 20%. Let's say that we can generate only $10,000 of spontaneous financing. We can slow down accounts payable by only about $10,000. Doesn't hurt it. Suppose that we use no spontaneous financing. Oh, isn't that interesting? The spontaneous financing really doesn't matter too much to this project. So we know now that we don't really have to worry about, we could even forget about slowing down payables. It's still a good project. We don't need to finance any of it through slowing down paying our bills. So we'll put that back up to 20,000. Now let's take a look at the one that might be interesting for us. What happens if we don't hit the initial year sales of 50,000? What if we make it only to 40,000 units in the first year? Ouch. Okay, how about 45,000? Whoa. Okay, so let's try 43,000. Every time we're seeing that internal rate of return method rejects a project much more quickly than will an NPV approach. Now, does that mean we should always use the NPV? Absolutely not. The company is going to decide on its own whether it wants to use NPVs to decide yes or no, or IRRs. But it's worth it for us to notice this, that, and this is not unusual, by the way. This is something that we see. Companies that use hurdle rate models will tend to reject more projects than companies that use NPV models. It's just sort of overall we see that. So in other words, this is touchy. It's trying 44,000. Yeah. So in other words, if we want both methods to say accept, we better get 44,000 units sold the first year. Let me go back up to 50,000. Suppose that we look at the price here. What happens if we charge $3 instead of $3.50 per unit? Look at that. It's always the IRR that starts bitching at us first. Okay, fine. How about at $3.25? Okay, we probably shouldn't go much below $3.25 to open the store on this one. If we want both of the models to be happy, we should probably go no lower than $3.25 per unit. And take this one, $3.50. Let me put that back to $3.50. Let's look at the tax rate. What happens if we increase the tax rate to 25%? Whoa! That really was a whack. Let's take it down to 24%. Yo! 23%? Well, internal rate of return is the first one to scream, as you've seen. And so in other words, it looks to me like if the tax rate goes up at even a small amount from 21 to 23%, it's just going to kill the project on the internal rate of return. So that we put that back to 21%. Now, one last one. Let's look at a growth rate of 2%. We projected 3%, but it's really not getting brand loyalty very quickly, not getting new customers. We're still good. 1%, still good. Suppose there's no growth of sales whatsoever. So in other words, that growth of sales is not really one of our concerns. As long as we keep sales flat. But what would happen if we took a negative? We actually decline in sales, negative 2%. Oops, negative 2%. We could even lose sales, and this project will be good. So in other words, the growth rate of sales is not a driving factor of whether we say yes or no. we could just have flat sales the whole 4 years of the project, and it will still be good for us. It'll still work for us. So the big driving factors are, to some extent, not surprisingly, what price you charge. We now know that we shouldn't go below 325 on the opening bell on this. We probably want to keep our cost of goods sold at least below 43%, and we know that we probably want to keep our selling, general, and administrative expenses below about 23%. This is sensitivity analysis. We do it all the time, and even in marketing, we work with the marketing people about this. What's your price point? How much leeway do we have? This is what tells us. This is a sensitivity analysis that the book is talking about, and now you see it. You've got a model for yourselves that you can use in other classes for a four-year project. I'm trying to think about one last point that I was going to make. Oh, yeah, the idea of spontaneous financing. It's something to bring up in this class, because they do mention it in the book, and they use it in a model, I believe, in one of their models in the book. So it's just something that's out there. As you can see, though, it really doesn't do a whole lot to a project like this one. The more of it, yeah, then you can push some of the other numbers around a little bit, but it is not critical to the up or down decision. This is the way that we actually do project whether to take on new projects or say no to them, usually with longer, like 5-10 year projection streams. But it all boils down to getting the numbers of free cash flow so that we can know whether to accept or reject the project. That's all I have for you today. Go home.